Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll find out more about a new law that will require media literacy to be taught in Illinois schools. Along with students and teachers returning to the classroom, there are a lot of questions about how this semester will go, especially with some kids still unable to be vaccinated. Vaccine hesitancy is a problem in many rural areas. Could farmers with a background in vaccines for livestock help change minds? And along with patients and families, COVID is again starting to overwhelm some hospitals and staff.
Probably not a day goes by that we don't just kind of convene and just kind of like, you know, just sigh and cry. And it's just been pretty horrible.
Also, a plan to honor the first black man in Illinois to legally cast a vote. That and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear how some teachers feel as they return to the classroom. We'll also learn more from a microbiologist about the Delta variant and how it now dominates new COVID cases. And also, we'll talk with nurses about what it's like to be on the front lines of the pandemic during another wave of COVID-19. That and more this hour on Statewide. Illinois is the first state to require news literacy courses at every high school. The hope is that it will provide the next generation tools to maneuver the internet's misinformation minefield. Peter Midland has more details.
Here's an example of one startling experiment. Researchers showed an anonymous Facebook video to more than 3,000 American high schoolers. The video circulated before the 2016 presidential election and claimed to show people ballot stuffing during that year's primaries. They asked students a simple question. Is this strong evidence of voter fraud in the U.S.?
Out of those more than 3,000 students, three figured out that actually the video came from Russia.
That's Joel Breakstone, who heads the Stanford History Education Group, which conducted the study.
There is a widespread misconception that because young people are adept at using digital devices, that they are also skilled at making sense of the information that those devices provide.
Under the new curriculum, Illinois students will analyze news content across platforms. Breakstone's group spent the last year working with ninth graders at a suburban Chicago high school, integrating news literacy into subjects like geography and biology. It found that what helps students distinguish misinformation the most is something called lateral reading. That can be as simple as opening a new tab and leaving the post to find more about the source of information. It appears to be effective. Students reportedly got a lot better at spotting questionable sources. But this effort takes time and practice. Students say they often didn't see why, for example, a company writing about climate change receiving funding from the fossil fuel industry could skew the story. Many assume that if a social media influencer has tons of followers, it means they're trustworthy. Students like this Naperville, Illinois freshman practiced by finding popular social media posts about nutrition and recording themselves fact-checking like this.
Okay, so I found this post on Instagram. So as you can see right here, it says that she is a dietitian. And there's also another place right here that even shows like she has a diploma in clinical nutrition.
For this to work, teachers also have to be media savvy. Students say they often struggle because the strategies teachers provide for evaluating sources can be outdated. Peter Adams heads the News Literacy Project, which trains teachers, provides lesson plans, and sometimes brings them into newsrooms to show the reporting process. Adams says many teachers worry about being perceived as partisan.
We really encourage folks to redirect that into looking at standards and practices and really comparing coverage.
And teachers have to create a classroom experience where students feel comfortable talking about political issues, all while knowing how and when to push back on baseless conspiracy theories. Teacher Allie Neese has had to fight back on misinformation about the January 6th attack on the Capitol that students brought to her government class in Chicago.
We are not here to deny them the ability to engage in dialogues and discourse where they disagree, but there is a difference when the issues that we are bringing to the table and talking about are issues, are important.
Neese likes to give examples of what journalism can do, citing history and the disclosure of things like the Pentagon Papers. The Illinois law will go into effect with the 2022-23 school year, and at this point, 14 other states have some media literacy standards already in the books. I'm Peter Medlin.
The new school year is upon us, and that means teachers are preparing for another uncertain period under the threat of a pandemic. This time around, most students are coming back to the classrooms, but some teachers say they'll be welcoming them with mixed emotions. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan has more.
Rachel Esposito knows how she wants her classroom to look when students arrive next week. She's an eighth grade language arts teacher in Southwest suburban Cicero.
So I do have to get some new plants, lots of chart paper to go, you know, on the bulletin boards, make it colorful.
The Cicero School District is mostly Latino, and Esposito wants her students to feel like they belong there.
I did purchase some new posters this year that really feature more Latinx community members and other minority leaders to just inspire my students.
She wants to bring a sense of normalcy to yet another unusual and uncertain year shaped by the pandemic. Most students are going back to classrooms, but coronavirus cases among children are on the rise as the new highly infectious Delta variant is quickly spreading. Esposito, who's also the Cicero Teachers Union president, says teachers have many concerns.
We're worried about positive cases. We're worried about what quarantine is going to look like. We're worried about mask wearing. Also, we're still worried about ventilation. We know that our district has taken some steps to improve ventilation in our schools, but now with being at 100% capacity, things are going to change.
Esposito says this is a good time for all school districts to think about what's working in public education and what's not. For example, instead of spending more time, money, and energy on standardized testing,
I think that we need to put more emphasis and funding into our social work in districts as well as nursing. The state needs to look at that and see how we can get more qualified adults to help and provide services for our students.
Monica Rojas, a former Acero Charter School teacher in Chicago, agrees. Her Southwest Side school struggled to give students what they needed last year. She says the learning gaps she keeps hearing about weren't caused only by remote learning or the pandemic.
They come from us not having enough staff. For example, like this past year, I was teaching a lot of different things, and one teacher cannot give the support to 64 students the same way that two teachers would be able to. Or three teachers would be able to.
She recently got a job at a Chicago public school on the South Side, where she hopes to find more guidance from her principal. Rojas is excited, but with just 2 weeks before most students return to the classroom, other CPS teachers aren't as optimistic. CPS and its teachers union haven't reached a new reopening agreement on issues like COVID-19 testing, quarantining, and remote learning.
In my case, my major concern is how the plan for helping the kids get vaccinated is going to work out.
In Northwest suburban Elgin, Jesus Diaz, the dual language lead teacher at Abbott Middle School, fears that not all vaccine eligible students are getting the shots. But beyond his concerns, Diaz is looking forward to adding new tech strategies he used during remote teaching last year. His district gives each student a computer, and Diaz is using a new application.
This allows the integration of Google Apps. It allows the integration of students recording themselves through video and audio.
Esposito, the teacher from Cicero, wants to incorporate more technology in her lessons too, but her main focus is on personal connections.
Relationships with kids come first.
She says this is something she already knew and practiced, but was reaffirmed last year.
If you can have a good relationship with your students and they feel respected, then they're going to work for you. They're going to do things that maybe they won't do for other teachers.
Despite all the unknowns, Diaz, Esposito, and other teachers are eager to work with kids face-to-face again. They say they're not as worried about bringing students up to speed academically. Teachers are used to that. But they say checking in on their social-emotional well-being while helping them relearn how to be back in school will be challenging and extremely important. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan, WBEC News.
A group of Northern Illinois Girl Scouts recently took a trip down memory lane to share how the pandemic has affected their lives. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
On my honor, I will...
Color markers and white sheets of paper greeted the girls as they came together at Camp Greenwood in Naperville. These art supplies kept these youngsters occupied while they shared stories and documented their experiences during COVID-19. Candace Schaefer is the Senior Director of Corporate Partnerships with Girl Scouts of Greater Chicago and Northwest Indiana. She says, in addition to celebrating National S'mores Day, something the group often does, they are also encapsulating the pandemic through the Girl Scouts' eyes. She says the parents will play a role in the celebration by sharing their own stories
and bond over some of the things that have happened in their lives and how it's altered them and moved them forward as leaders and as girls of courage, confidence, and character.
Girl Scouts partner with Once Upon Our Time Capsule to help capture these pandemic memories that the children have. Stacy Gillette is a co-founder of this group. The organization was created several months ago when Gillette and co-founder Stephanie Hodges realized there weren't a lot of platforms for children to voice and process the impacts of the pandemic. This duo helps children capture these moments and put them into things that can be used as a time capsule. This could be anything from a shoebox to a mason jar.
So as an example, you might see a kid who was talking about they were stuck at home a lot. They decided to learn guitar for the first time. And so then they include their first guitar pick, you know, as an example of what we're seeing come through.
Michelle Harback was there with her 11-year-old daughter, Chloe. She says Chloe became a Girl Scout this past October.
And one of the reasons we joined was because being at home and sort of in quarantine, she didn't have a lot of contact with other children. And so I wanted her to be able to have some opportunities to socialize.
So I get to meet with other people, other girls, and do fun activities.
That was Chloe explaining her virtual Girl Scout experience as she sat at a picnic table drawing animals. Now, you may not have seen Girl Scouts in front of stores with boxes of cookies during the pandemic, but that doesn't mean sales weren't being made. Schaefer says, like many other institutions, the group went virtual.
So girls were able to sell through email, through social media, through their like virtual cookie booths, things like that, super fun. But our goal really through all of this was to be that solid organization for girls to lean back into and be there for when they were ready for us.
Harback says her daughter had a goal to sell 50 boxes when she first joined, but ended up doubling that without leaving her home. Once the Scouts finished their art projects, they dropped them into a big bin along with other capsules they created. These will be sealed, and 5 years from now, the girls will be able to look back on them. The parents join in on the fun by putting sticky tabs with their memorable events on a huge timeline pasted on the side of the building. Afterwards, groups of girls stood around a fire pit toasting marshmallows for their graham crackers and Hershey chocolates. The evening ended with everyone standing in a circle and singing Girl Scout songs.
Okay, let's put it together.
I'm Yvonne Blue.
There are no bananas in the sky, in the sky. There are no bananas in the sky, in the sky.
Farmers and ranchers are trusted voices in their rural communities, and because of their work with animals, they understand the science and value of vaccines. That could make them perfectly positioned to help nudge their vaccine-hesitant neighbors to roll up their sleeves. Christine Herman went to find out if farmers are taking on the challenge.
When the coronavirus vaccine first became available for him in Illinois, Tom Arnold says he didn't need any convincing. He raises cattle, hogs, and chickens in Elizabeth, a small rural town in the northwest corner of the state.
Some friends, they said, well, you know, we don't trust the vaccine. Other people still weren't convinced that the vaccine was the way to go. And I always felt that was a little cavalier. I felt I had no problem being vaccinated myself.
After all, who better to understand why herd immunity matters than a herdsman?
Being a livestock producer, I'm well aware of vaccinations and vaccines. That's how we develop immunity in our animals. We're always vaccinating the breeding stock to pass on immunity to the little ones.
The problem is that Arnold's among the minority of people in his county who've chosen to get the vaccine. Scientists warn under-vaccinated parts of the country are at serious risk, especially with the more contagious Delta variant spreading. Arnold believes the vaccine saves lives, but he doesn't think it's his job to convince neighbors or friends. He says it's too politicized.
I don't want to get into a discussion on right or wrong.
Plus, he gets it. There's just so much information floating around, he says it's hard to know what to believe. And he doesn't think he personally could change anyone's mind. Larry Lieb feels the same way. He's 69 and lives in central Illinois, where he's got 92 acres of soybeans and timber and raises a few cows and pigs.
Come here, pig.
Leib says he was a little worried himself because the vaccine was developed so fast, and he really only got it for one reason.
My daughter's a respiratory therapist, and she told me I was going to get it, plain and simple.
Unlike some of his relatives, Leib says he does not buy into conspiracy theories about the vaccine, but he avoids those conversations altogether.
It's their own personal choice. I mean, you know, on issues where they're set in their ways, you know, I mean, it's futile to try.
Leib and Arnold belong to the National Farmers Union, which has been urging its members to speak up about the vaccine in their rural communities. But it's not easy. Carrie Cochran-McLean is with the National Rural Health Association, which is also hoping that more rural Americans will get vaccinated if they hear from trusted neighbors like Arnold.
One of the hardest things about the vaccination effort is that it really, at this point, is almost down to those one-on-one kind of conversations and message sharing. And so he may not feel like his voice is much, but we believe that it's very strong and important.
Ryan Goodman has heard the calls from the national level, and he's giving it a try. He's a cattle rancher in Virginia and self-described agriculture advocate. On Instagram and Twitter, he's known as the Beef Runner. Goodman has been using social media to engage with his followers about the vaccine. He says he's not sure he's changed any minds, but he's encouraged when skeptics who seem unconvinced return for more dialogue.
You know, I'm a fan of saying no one conversation changes someone's mind, especially when you disagree on a topic that might be as hot or as political as vaccines and these vaccine programs.
Goodman wants to see more farmers speaking up because in rural towns, he says farmers are more likely to be believed than even health experts.
You know, everybody looks at Joe down the road and thinks, hey, you know, what might be his experiences on this topic or this issue, or kind of listens to what he or she may say.
Tom Arnold also sees himself as trusted in his community. He says he'll answer questions if people ask him, but he's a pretty busy guy.
I'm already overworked and underpaid. There are other people I feel that maybe retired or have more free time that should be doing those things.
Meanwhile, only about 40% of his county is fully vaccinated. He says he doesn't really get why people are acting like the pandemic's over. I'm Christine Herman.
Well, stay with us. We'll learn more about why hot weather can interfere with sleep for crops. That story is on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, a small town in Illinois plans to honor the first black man to cast a vote in the state. We'll have that story. Well, do you find yourself not sleeping well during really hot weather? Well, you're not alone. Some crops suffer with warmer nighttime temperatures, too. And as Christine Stella with Harvest Public Media reports, that's expected to become more of a problem in coming years.
Some farmers say that if you listen to their cornfields closely enough, you might hear more than ears of corn rustling in the wind. You could catch the sound of it growing. There are recordings, like this one, taken by agronomists at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Farmers pray every year for conditions that will make their crops sing like that. Enough moisture, proper sun, no bad weather. In 2020, on top of the year's many problems, a stubborn enemy emerged for farmers across the Great Plains: drought. Dry conditions can hurt a crop's yield by interrupting photosynthesis. Air plus water plus sunlight equals corn. But drought conditions can also go hand in hand with warmer weather. Too little or too much heat at the wrong time can doom a farmer's field. Brian Fuchs, a climatologist at the U.S. National Drought Center, says both can arise in a heartbeat.
For the most part, the timing of that warmth is really key to how not only producers themselves deal with it, but how the plants and the crops that they're trying to grow deal with it.
Corn is especially picky about nighttime temperatures early in its life. If just a few evenings at the start of the growing season are hotter than 50 degrees, that can trigger a cascade of problems, including the plant losing essential carbon and water. Dr. Waleed Sadok, an agronomist at the University of Minnesota, says the effect is similar to getting a bad night's sleep, which can stunt the plant's growth.
When you have that increase in nighttime temperature, the plant does not recover well in the following day. It's kind of dizzy.
Climate change is expected to make drought heat waves, and warm nighttime temperatures more common in coming decades. And while they don't always go hand in hand, a warmer world could make drought worse in the future.
There is no doubt that frequency of those extreme events is on the rise. We need to make crops more resilient to stresses like drought, high temperature, high nighttime temperature, fast enough to fulfill the need of a growing population.
The search for more resilient plants begins in virtual reality with crop modeling. Sadok uses computer models to test how changing a plant's genes would impact its growth. It's sort of similar to playing a really complicated video game. It's all about trial and error. Plants like corn have about 12,000 more genes than humans, and changing them to make the crop tougher against, say, high heat could make it weaker to something else, like drought.
What we are discovering is that you can improve a variety to be more tolerant in one environment, but it could be really a loser in another environment.
While there's still a lot of work ahead to create enough varieties for farmers to use globally, Sadok says scientists are making good progress. Yet stronger plants alone will not save farmers. Tala Awada, a plant ecophysiologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says they need a bigger toolkit, including better resource management.
You can go with using sensing technologies to drive management practices, such as when you put your nutrients, when you water, and so all of it is technology-driven and sensing-driven.
The technology is there. Whether it's accessible to farmers is another question. She says that will drive whether more people invest in equipment that reduces their risk.
All these technological advancements and innovations that are driving many of the solutions, but they have to be two things, affordable and manageable.
Farming has always been risky, but to prepare for a changing climate, Awada says scientists will keep developing tools to help farmers counter uncertainty. But those will take time to perfect, and for some solutions, farmers might just have to wait. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
A tradition at the Illinois State Fair continued this past week. The Governor's Sale of Champions took place, and it saw a bidding war between Governor J.B. Pritzker and First Lady M.K. Pritzker. The First Lady won out with a record-setting bid of $105,000 for a steer, who is, by the way, named Bob. Also a winner was a Winchester High School senior, Landry Freeman. She raised the steer. She'll get half the proceeds. The rest will be split between other breed champions, as well as 4-H and the FFA. The meat goes to charity. Well, maybe you watched the baseball game at the iconic Field of Dreams site in Iowa, but did you know it has a strong connection to Bradley University in Peoria? Joe Deacon has that story.
Braves junior golfer John Stillman grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, the son of Bradley alums Mike and Denise. Just over a decade ago, the Stillmans visited the site and soon learned it was for sale. Denise Stillman had a grand vision for the property with a ball diamond nestled into an Iowa cornfield.
It immediately just popped in my mom's head, well, what if we made it a Cooperstown, like the youth baseball complex in Cooperstown, Cooperstown of the Midwest?
The Stillmans led a group of investors in acquiring the site in 2012. In the years since, his parents divorced and Denise succumbed to cancer in 2018. But the development overcame a host of obstacles and is now in the spotlight with Stillman's beloved White Sox taking on the Yankees.
Seeing all of it, it's hard to, you know, even just grasp it because it's just, you know, it's been a lot of years in the making. But in my opinion, it just makes it all worth it. There's some people that may be like, well, the movie site was just, you know, meant to be a tranquil place and, you know, nothing else. But for me, I think it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life.
Stillman says both the field and the film inspire a magical feeling that resonates with fans. I'm Joe Deacon.
And the White Sox won the game on a walk-off home run into the cornfield. Listening to Statewide. Efforts are underway to create a museum in Woodford County dedicated to the first black man in Illinois to cast a ballot after the ratification of the 15th Amendment. Tim Shelley spoke with Michael Melick, a board member of the Project 15 Museum in El Paso.
I'm one of the social studies teacher at El Paso Gridley High School. And through our investigating history class, we discovered that there was the first black voter in the state of Illinois is from our town here in El Paso. And then through some additional discovery, we found out that the place where he had his barber shop for several decades is still in existence. And then through a little bit more research, we found out that the building owners of that building were interested in preserving his legacy by turning the space into a museum. So I had my investigating history class do some research and create 8 different proposals for exhibits that we could place into this museum. And the building owners are like, all right, let's do it. And I'm like, wait, what? And they're like, let's actually open a museum. I'm like, this was just a thought experiment, a hypothetical. And they're like, no, let's do it. Let's open a museum. And so here we are. We started a not-for-profit, Project 15, and our goal is to tell this story, this history that belongs in El Paso, of David Strother being the first black man in the state of Illinois to vote after the certification of the 15th Amendment, and then to expand on that legacy by continuing to advocate for voters and voting rights and election security.
So let's talk a little bit about the building itself. So this building you're hoping will actually house this museum talking about David Strother and voting rights.
Yeah, so the building is located at 1 West Front Street, right in downtown El Paso at the corner of Front Street and Central Street. And he actually had a subterranean barbershop. It was underground. And there was a staircase right off of Central Street that you could take down to his barbershop. And that still exists. Actually, even after David passed in the early 20th century, other barbers continued to operate. And they were still giving haircuts well into the late 1900s. Several people in town have stories recalling how they used to go to that barbershop to get haircuts when they were younger. Since that time, the city has closed up that subterranean access and put sidewalk over it. So one of our first and unfortunately more expensive projects is going to be reopening that sidewalk to get subterranean access to the location of his barbershop. And then we'll also have to renovate it. And we're going to try and get it as close to the 1890s style that we can.
And where exactly are you at in timeline?
Yeah, so the class that I taught that kind of came up with a lot of these ideas, I taught in 2019. And so it's been kind of a slow roll these first couple years, kind of getting things going, getting things in place, talking about, can we do this? Do we have enough support from our community and from the region? And once we decided that, you know what, whether we have the support or not, we've got to make an effort to make this happen, we're like, all right, let's get organized and let's welcome people to our journey. And
do you have a fundraising goal you're trying to hit?
Really, more than the money at this point, we need allies. We need people who support our cause, who want to see this come about. And it's not a one-off, let's get this pile of money thing. It's a, we're starting a long journey. This is a single step. Who would like to walk beside us? Honestly, people are everything, you know, dollars will be there if the people support it. And so we're looking to get people more than money.
Anything else you want to add or you'd like to tell people about this?
David Strother's story is an amazing one. It very easily could have been a heartbreaking one, but it's not. It's a celebration. He was able to exercise his right to vote, as was his brother a couple hours later, and that needs to be celebrated. We'll be making plans to tell this story to a much larger audience, and we'll be gearing up to fight for those whose right to vote is still being compromised. So we've got a lot of work to do, but it's great work, and it's work that makes us a great country.
That's Michael Melick. He's a board member of the Project 15 Museum in El Paso in central Illinois. The museum would be dedicated to a local resident who was the first black man in the state to cast a ballot after the 15th Amendment was ratified. COVID cases are rising once again in Illinois and most of the country, and the more contagious Delta variant now makes up the vast majority of new coronavirus cases. To learn more about how the variants have changed over time in Illinois and what that means on a practical level, Christine Herman spoke with Sarah Patrick. She's the acting state epidemiologist in Illinois.
Viruses typically do change, and they change so that it can survive. As a virus moves through different populations, it will start to mutate. In the spring of this year, the WHO, World Health Organization, changed some of the nomenclature that we were using to describe the viruses. Rather than name them after the country where that mutation was found, they gave them Greek letters. And so Alpha was originally talked about as B117. And it was really the first variant that we saw in Illinois of concern. And that was in, you know, February, early March. It did have higher transmissibility than previous versions of the virus, but really just kind of went along. And so we have a lot of those cases reported on our website because that's a cumulative count. The next one that came up was called P1, or also referred to as Gamma. And we had some really interesting patterns with that because Gamma really seeded itself in central Illinois. And at one point, Illinois had the most of this variant reported compared to other states in the nation. But one of the things we proved is when you vaccinate around it, when you do your case investigations, when people participate in contact tracing, and we can get people in for testing as fast as possible and get them into quarantine, the people who are exposed, we were actually able to bring down those numbers. And even though Gamma exists in certain communities in very low levels now, it's not the dominant variant in the state now. Next up was Delta. It got introduced in Illinois in about April. And one of the things that we're learning through the science is just how much more transmissible it is. We're still studying how severe it is and whether or not it causes more hospitalization or deaths.
So just a few questions about the data that IDPH reports. Where does it come from exactly? Is IDPH doing the sequencing, or are you more so aggregating data that is being sequenced by other labs that is then submitted to the state?
So IDPH has three different laboratories in the state. The Chicago and Springfield locations do our genomic sequencing. We have a partner at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale that had started doing sequencing for us even before we were able to start doing the sequencing ourselves. So we didn't build up that capacity in the IDPH lab in Carbondale. So we do sequence specimens, and we have asked hospitals and providers to send us specimens. We prioritize people who are hospitalized, specimens that are part of outbreaks, and individuals who have breakthrough disease. We also know that there's data coming in from other locations as well, and we try to get our arms around that as well. About 9.8% of all PCR positive tests in Illinois do get sequenced at this current time. We're much higher than many states in the U.S.
About 92% of cases from the first 2 weeks of August so far have been Delta. Can we say with some degree of certainty that 90% of all COVID positive cases in Illinois are Delta, or is that not accurate since the samples that are sequenced were not randomly selected?
Well, randomization would be perfect, but it's extremely difficult to do when you literally have thousands of laboratories across the state. What we try to do is look at what is that change over time from a given data source. So if we're looking at the CDC program, their most recent data goes through July 17th, and nationally Delta is about 94%, and in Illinois for that same time frame is 87%. But of course, we are looking at what's coming into the state lab and other sources, and it is bumping up. The main take-home point is, yes, Delta is the most common variant that's circulating in Illinois right now. Will Delta stay there? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it'll behave just like Alpha did, where it was dominant for many, many weeks, actually months, and then got squeezed out by another variant. The take-home message is we need to get people vaccinated. We need to make sure that the variant, that any virus doesn't have room to move within the population.
That's Sarah Patrick, the acting state epidemiologist for the Illinois Department of Public Health, and she spoke with Christine Herman. Just ahead on Statewide, we'll hear from some nurses about what it's like to be on the front lines of the pandemic. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The COVID-19 pandemic has strained hospitals and their staffs across the U.S. for nearly a year and a half. Healthcare workers say they want people who have questions or concerns about the COVID vaccine to ask them about it, but emergency room and intensive care nurses rarely get that chance. Eric Stock with member station WGLT talked with two nurses at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. Marissa Smith works in intensive care, and Alizarin Salmi works in the emergency department. Salmi explains how she copes with the stress of the pandemic when a vast majority of people hospitalized are unvaccinated.
I think it would be impossible not to be frustrated at times with the situation, but I think that we always kind of take the new information and process it and then regroup and come back with a game face on. So I think in general, everyone is staying very positive and we're ready to, you know, keep fighting.
A big difference between where we are now and where we were a year ago, as cases increase, is, of course, there is now a vaccine that was not available. And a majority of the patients hospitalized locally and nationally are not vaccinated. So what are those conversations like with patients and their families? Have they asked for the vaccine? Have families talked about it? How does that come up, or does it, Marissa?
We are seeing patients that are not vaccinated still. A lot of times it will be kind of a cursory conversation like, did you get your vaccine? I am a strong believer in treating the disease and not blaming the person. And so anyone who comes to us that's not vaccinated, that was a personal choice that they made, just like every other personal choice that they make. I try to respect that because I would like them to respect mine. And I just try to preach that among my coworkers as well. But, you know, there have been times patients have asked us for the vaccine and they're already critically ill and, you know, it's too late. And so that can get kind of heart-wrenching because you know kind of where they're at and that they're scared and they're reaching out for a life raft that isn't actually there. You know, the vaccine is important. That's, you know, to get it as quickly as possible, as soon as it's available for you. And hopefully, you know, you will stay healthy in all ways, but you know, that's the best that we can do. You know, I can't necessarily impose my beliefs on someone. I can't necessarily argue with someone about it. I can only tell them what, you know, we're being told is that it's the best choice for us right now.
Alizarin, there's been a lot of public discussion about talk to your doctor, talk to your healthcare provider about this, and you know, your medical experts as well, but by the time they see you, it's too late. So if you could share your reflections on that and your experiences with patients during this time.
We've seen all different people in the ER, and the conversation does come up whether people have gotten the vaccine or not. And like Marissa said, it's not in a judgmental way. I haven't personally had someone ask me to give them the vaccine, but I've had people ask for resources or where can I go, you know, if I'm interested in it, or I've heard this about the vaccine. Is that what you're seeing? And we always try to give factual information to them and help them make the decision. Ultimately, it is their decision, and nursing has to be impartial. We take care of people who make all kinds of life decisions that lead them to the ER or ICU, and your care is completely separate from your beliefs and, you know, how you feel that they should be thinking about this vaccine.
It has to be tough, though, to note that the information is out there, and a lot of times it's not getting through despite attempts by the media, healthcare, health professionals. Any thoughts about that? About how the message isn't getting through, Marissa?
I think that there is a significant deficit in health literacy in the American public. There are a lot of people out there who don't necessarily know what the right sources of information are. You know, if you see a banner like the Centers for Disease Control, you're like, oh, those are the people who will know. But then that is not necessarily where people are going for their information. They're going to their friends and neighbors. They're going to their workplace. They're going to, you know, the social media accounts. They're going to the news, which, you know, those are all places where you would maybe get a recommendation from someone, but that's not where you should be getting your health care information from. And like you were saying, you know, people contacting their healthcare professionals 100%, we should advocate for that, because those are going to be the people who are going to have the best ability to have most educated conversation with those individuals.
That's Marissa Smith and Alizarin Salmi, nurses at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal, and they spoke with Eric Stock. Sherry Pipkins has been on the front lines of the battle against COVID for 17 months. As the lead respiratory care practitioner at Missouri's SSM Health St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Charles, she helps patients with breathing problems, which is a major part of caring for COVID patients because the disease affects the lungs. Pipkins and her team are experiencing their third wave of patients. She says those she's treating now are younger than the ones in the previous waves. Sarah Finsky of St. Louis Public Radio spoke with her.
So take us back to the first wave of the pandemic. When did you first realize COVID patients would be a big part of your caseload?
When they first started coming in and they just started deteriorating really quickly, one patient I remembered, one of my team members would check their oxygen level and then they'd go back for a breathing treatment and their oxygen level would be just a little lower, and by the end of the day, they would be on a ventilator. Mm. We are seeing that deteriorate even quicker.
So for people coming in this Delta wave, they're just going downhill fast.
Very much more quicker, yes.
And this is after you've had a year and a half to work on techniques and fine-tuning things. It feels like there's not really any palliative measure here that's been developed that is going to save these people.
We have basic things that we're doing. Of course, the steroids, the antibiotics, remdesivir. I mean, all of the things that fit inside the box, we do try for these patients. This Delta variant is just taking people by storm.
Have you noticed differences in who is getting sick this time? Demographically, are there any differences?
So let me just clarify really quick. I am not one to push my beliefs on anyone. I just, when the vaccine came out at first, I was very hesitant myself. But what I found is that the people that are coming in are the unvaccinated. I mean, I would say 97%. I'm not a big numbers person, but I would say 97% of the people that are coming in and the people that have passed in our small hospital alone are the people that are unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm. So statistically, we heard a lot in the first wave that this was mostly elderly people, and the elderly actually have great vaccination rates compared to so
yes,
many younger
yes,
people.
I agree.
Are you still seeing mostly elderly patients this time around?
No. We have had people on our ICU is just like packed at any given time. With anywhere between 30s, 40s, 50s, and not overweight necessarily. In the past, we were seeing more of the overweight population, the elderly population. There is no respecter of race, size, age at this point, and no pre-existing issues. The people that do survive are the fortunate ones, and they are actually walking out of the hospital, but they are walking out, going home on oxygen. They are going home, not able to even go back to their jobs because they're needing therapy as far as like physical therapy, occupational therapy, pulmonary rehab. I mean, they're just so sick. Where they didn't have lung disease before, now they have a lung disease. No smoking history. Now their lungs look like they've smoked for many, many years.
I mean, it's just terrifying to hear you say that. And you're talking about younger people. I think so many of us who aren't elderly were thinking during these first couple waves, okay, we want to do our part to protect others, but if we get this, we're going to come through this fine. Are these people expressing surprise and confusion that they're now suffering to this extent?
Yes, they are. I have a couple of patients right now that I'm taking care of that one of them is just like literally in tears almost the whole time and just apologetic. And just, I mean, at this point in the game, now my goal is to just get you better and get you out of here. It's not, you know, now we're just past that point. You know, you didn't get vaccinated. We don't need to discuss that at this point. Now I just need to get you better. You know, I have a patient that the mom and the patient were in here together. The mom was on the ventilator. The mom did not survive, and the patient is still here, and I'm trying to get him better and get him out of here. It's horrifying. It's just horrific. It's horrific for mostly the families and the population, but also for the healthcare workers. I mean, Probably not a day goes by that we don't just kind of convene and just kind of like, you know, just sigh and cry. And it's just been pretty horrible.
You find yourself in tears almost every day on the job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so hard. And I guess so many of us who are outside the healthcare system, we hear people say things like, well, if people didn't get vaccinated, they're asking for it. And here are these people who didn't get vaccinated. Do you feel some of that same anger that they're putting you in this position?
I don't feel that anger. I'm just here to care for the patient. And I feel a little frustration, I guess I should say. I don't feel anger toward them. I feel frustration. It's hard to just, you know, see them in that vulnerable state and feel anger.
But the frustration is real.
The frustration, yes, it is real.
You mentioned that you were initially a little bit hesitant about getting this vaccination yourself. Why were you hesitant and what ended up changing your mind?
Of course, it rolled out really quickly. I mean, everybody could admit that, but, mm-hmm. You know, as it rolled out, I just decided that, you know, okay, so you just ask yourself that, do you know anybody personally that has died from COVID? And, you know, as these months and months and months roll around, whether it be the first wave or now we're in the Delta, everybody can probably say that they know somebody personally or they know a friend that has a family member that has died of COVID mm-hmm. at this point. I don't know anybody that's died from the vaccine. I mean, if they got the vaccine and you hear these stories about people that have died, you know, they have had some kind of pre-existing issue in the first place. And, you know, I just say, in my opinion, that the risk of not getting the vaccine by far is higher than the risk of the risk of getting COVID.
Yet, to me, a shocking number of healthcare workers aren't vaccinated. I saw a recent statistic, nearly 1 in 3 workers at the nation's 50 largest hospitals. How is that possible when you see what you just described to me, what you all are seeing on the job?
I don't know. I think that's a personal, a personal thing. We just try to keep that private amongst ourselves, I guess. But it can be frustrating at times.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have to work together as a team, right? You're there in kind of these high-stress situations.
Yeah, we do. And we mask and we distance and we do our part even in our own, you know, department in our private time as well, you know, when we're not with patients. And so we do our part.
We spoke with a WashU researcher just a couple weeks ago. She talked about persuading the unvaccinated. She said we need to pull on our empathy reserves in order not to push the unvaccinated farther into their views. I imagine a lot of people in your life outside of your job want to talk to you about what you're seeing and, you know, are interested in hearing your experience. Has it been tough not to just, you know, let things boil over and give them an earful?
You know, it's with HIPAA, you know, you can't share a whole lot, but, you know, I have been able to, you know, share stories in generalities, and hopefully that will persuade them to understand that the risk of the vaccine is by far minimal compared to what we're seeing, and the risk of, like I said before, walking away with now a lung disease where you had none.
Heidi Lucas of the Missouri Nurses Association, she said that the trauma that nurses are experiencing from this will likely have lasting effects. Do you think that's true for you and your colleagues who are there on the front lines?
Absolutely. You know, as time, you know, they say time heals all wounds, but, you know, I think this is going to stick with us for some time to come. I've been in respiratory since 1992. You know, my husband even asked me one time, you know, not to sound cold-hearted or anything, but, you know, you deal with death and dying all the time. How is this any different? And, you know, it's just, it's so different. It's not like we deal with death and dying every single day in these numbers. You know, you try to get these people better in this unknown world. You stick with this patient. You build a relationship with this patient. You build a relationship with patients' families via FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And then only to come back, you may have one day off, and you come back, and that patient has passed. And you're just torn.
That's Sherry Pipkins, the lead respiratory care practitioner at Missouri's SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. She talked with Sarah Finsky. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Join us next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find our podcast at statewideshow.com and through the NPR One app. Don't miss an episode. You can also like us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.